Continue now with the third prayer of the betrothal service. Last week we spoke about the betrothal of Isaac to Rebecca. And this week we will try to spend a little time with some of the main topics of this prayer. Some of them we already have addressed in the past. But today we'll talk about the importance of the name and the person in Orthodox theology, and also the importance of those magic words, the words, I love you. Let's read the prayer, which says, O Lord our God, do you yourself bless the betrothal of these your servants, John and Yeriah, and confirm the word that has been spoken by them. For you, O Lord, from the beginning have created male and female, and by you is a woman joined to a man for assistance and for the continuation of the human race. So here we see the importance the church ascribes to the person by announcing the first name of each spouse. Not Mr. Douglas or Mr. Jones or Mrs. Papadopoulos, but John, Vasilios, Paul, Christina, Eleni, Chrissa, Stamatios. These two people are unique. They are special, never to be repeated in world history ever again. And just like God is hypostatic, God is personal, these two special people are called to establish a personal relationship with God, their Father, and a very personal relationship between them, with each other, always by the blessing of their mother church. Sometimes some of our people bring names to the altar for memorial services, and they add the last names along with the first names, Vasilios Papadopoulos, or Jim Stathis, or John Jones. You don't need to include last names. God does not need last names or email addresses. God knows you as a person before all ages. He has the hairs of your head counted, not because he's interested in the color of your hair, but to show you that he knows every minute and infinitesimal detail about your life, which happens to be very dear to him. Please pay attention to this very important detail of this prayer and practice it, whether you are single, engaged, or married. When you introduce your wife or your husband at a function, it is very bad practice to say to your supervisor or to your co-workers or to your friend, oh, this is my wife or this is my husband, or my brother or college roommate. Learn to always include the first name, not just in the beginning, but throughout your relationship. Hi, Michael, I would like you to introduce to you Michelle, my wife. Susan, I would like you to meet Anthony, my husband. What may sound like an insignificant detail at first can provide an antidote for the gradual lack of respect between spouses. She's not just your wife or just your husband. Or I got to call my husband, people say. We must learn to maintain and preserve the personal attributes of each person. They are a unique person who freely chose to be your husband or your wife. And the mystery of marriage is not some type of a blender that mixes the attributes of both people into one mass. In this great mystery, these two people are united into one flesh without losing their personal characteristics. Much like the mystery of the Holy Trinity, the personal attributes of each person of the Godhead are not mixed. They are of one essence, but they have their unique personal attributes. There's an unconfused union between the three persons in a relationship of love and perfect harmony. The church gives us our name during our baptism, where we receive our existence in God. We are reconciled and renewed as members of the church and grafted on the body of Christ. The name is connected to the person. That's why it is a demonic sin to attempt to reduce people to individuals, to simple numbers, to votes, tools of pleasure, gender or sex, male or female. The demon-possessed people in the town of Gadarenes became nameless. When Christ asked one of these poor young men, "What is your name?" the demons inside of him answered, "Legion," because we are thousands. The devil has no name. He's nameless because he lost his existence and connection to God. The devil and those he influences by his malicious energy attempt to reduce the value of the person, to decapitate the person. Julian the Apostate couldn't bear to call Jesus by his name. He would call him the Carpenter or the Nazarene or the Son of Mary. The Christians he would call those godless Galileans. We saw this very thing from the beginning of creation when Adam's relationship with Eve was at a healthy and natural state. Eve was the flesh from his flesh and bone of his bones, his beloved Eve, the mother of all living. After the fall and the injury of their paradisical state, she turned into a woman, into gender, the woman that you gave me. It is very sad, my young friends, to be at a family gathering or to have friends over and the husband here in Cyprus or Greece to tell his wife, "Gyneka, woman, make some extra coffee," or "we're ready to eat." Now, Gyneka in Greek coincides with the name wife, but still it is not characteristic of a cultivated soul to say, "wife, make some extra coffee." For those of you who still do this, please try to change this very bad habit. It does not cost anything to mix a little honey with your words. "Hey guys, Calliope has prepared something for us to enjoy while watching the football game. Calliope, is it ready yet? Let us know." Use the name, not just honey or dear, words that often subconsciously replace the name of the person. Use honey or dear along with the name. We said sin tries to decapitate a person according to the fathers. And when sin is not forgiven, when it festers, when the hurt is not healed, when we harbor resentment for our brother, we refuse to call them by name. We just say, "He did it. He said." 99% of the time, people will say, "My ex," not John or James or Mary, but "my ex." Sounds like we already have put an X on the existence of these people. That's why our church places a great emphasis on the healing and transformation of passions, because any passions, whether lust or greed or anger or pride, they decapitate the person. They reduce the person to an object. This is the reason why our church insists on the pronunciation of the name of the person, not only in the betrothal service, but during Holy Communion, even during funerals, and so on. Father Sofroni of Essex did not allow the parents to walk up with the children during Holy Communion. Now, it's understood that the children were at least 3-4 years old and they were coming there and quite comfortable with the environment. The small children were taught to walk up all by themselves as baptized members of the church. This is a great practice, and it helps the 3-year-old to become conscious of its existence and his or her membership to the body of Christ. The child will walk up, announce his name or her name, and will hear the name back. We'll hear the name repeated by the priest, the servant of God, Ioana, and so on. This is very profound, And please help the children to use their full baptismal names. Nicholas and not Nick. Andrew and not Drew. Peter and not Pete. Christina and not Tina. I'm saying this because after the 50s and 60s, along with all the other bad fruits that sprouted in our country here in Cyprus and Greece, you know, we also have to deal with the craze that decapitates all our baptismal names. We hear names like Akis, Makis, Lakis, Tula, Sula, Kula, Rula. Please use your baptismal names, which were given to honor your patron saints. Saints like Stamatios, Chrysoula, Chrysi, Alexander, Constantine. Not Kostakis, and then Kostakis becomes Akis. These nicknames should not find their place in the church. My young friends, if you have been abusing your baptismal names, and this may not be your fault, this, you know, you got help from your parents and grandparents, try to reverse this practice. Begin to introduce yourself with your baptismal name. My name is Stamatios. But when you were a toddler, grandma was calling you Stamatakis, little Stamatios. And then we ended up with the last two syllables of this beautiful name of a great martyr. And we ended up with Akis. And because dozens of Greek names end up with the same syllable, you become a nameless, because we don't know if you are Michalakis, Vasilakis, Kostakis, Giannakis, Stamatakis, Athanasakis. Your name is Athanasios. The name determines the person, identifies the person. A few years ago, I went to Egypt and we visited a Coptic monastery with Monophysite monks. And one of them was kind enough to come to help us as a tour guide. We introduce ourselves as monks from Mount Athos and so on. He asked, do you keep the church fasts in Mount Athos? And we said, by the grace of God, we try to keep all the fasts. Do you read the Desert Fathers? Of course, we read them. Do you know that St. Anthony was a Coptic? No, we were not aware of this. This is the first time we hear of such thing. Of course. Even St. Athanasius, the Bishop of Alexandria, was Coptic. Oh, I said, very good. What language do you speak? Well, Arabic. Very well. What does Athanasius mean in Arabic? Because that happens to be my name. St. Athanasius was not an Arab, did not speak Arabic. He spoke Greek. He was Rome Orthodox, Roman Orthodox, and had nothing to do with the Monophysite heresy of Eutychius and Dioscorus, which sprouted during the 5th century and condemned by the 4th Ecumenical Synod in Chalcedon. He was not Greek from Greece, no, but he was Rome Orthodox. And his name is very meaningful. Athanasios literally means one who never dies, similar to the word athanatos or immortal. Our God is athanatos, immortal. Once again, names are very meaningful. And when our Archangel Gabriel visited our Panagia, the Virgin Mary, he didn't say, give him any name you like. He said, you will give birth to a son and you will name him Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. The same angel 6 months prior went to Zacharias and told him, you will have a son and you will name him John. The name is very important. In the book of Revelation, John writes that after the restoration of all things, after the resurrection of the dead, during the second coming, we will have a new name. We will not be an anonymous mass. Christianity does not create masses like today's mass media. Christianity and the church is a community of distinct persons with their distinct names. So please, let's teach our children, grandchildren, and godchildren to use their baptismal names to honor their saints and martyrs for the glory of God. So we pray in this third prayer, bless the betrothal of these young servants, Maria and George, and confirm the word that has been spoken by them. What is the word spoken by them? It is amazing how some of these expressions continue in the various languages throughout the generations. We say in English, she is spoken for, or he is spoken for, meaning that she or he are promised away, they are taken. The word that has been spoken by them is the word of love. The one says, I love you, and the other one confirms the same thing by repeating that I love you too. These are the most important words, and all the weight of a betrothal or marriage relationship falls upon these two, three words, I love you, period. Not I love you with a number of strings attached. I love you, but we must live in this city, in this suburb, in a two-story, four-bedroom, three-bath home with a two-car garage and a couple of pets away from your mother. This is a terrible thing. Before they even begin to know each other, they make a list of demands. How many children they are going to have, where to send them to school. This is not the way to do things. You go out for your first meeting and you tell your betrothal candidate, okay, I want three children. Is that okay with you? If you want any more, then I'm sorry, but I don't agree. Or some people do this other strange thing. They write down a list of 10 things. So the one writes 10 things and that they expect from their spouse. And then the other one writes another 10 things. And then at their next meeting, they discuss, you know, these different things. This reminds of corporate negotiations before corporate mergers, not to mention today's prenuptial agreements, which clearly show that the material wealth is as important or more important than the words, I love you, and the person you're trying to unite with. All these lame agreements are futile if you're not willing to cultivate a deep and unconditional relationship in the name of love. In a few months, we will be calling each other a liar and a deceiver because clause number 8 of our promises is being violated. But you promised me a house or a boat. This is the wrong foundation. I remember a very good friend of mine from Syria. He befriended a young woman from his village back home, and he asked her, now, what kind of home do you like to live in if we got married? And listen to the answer of this very wise, young, properly brought up Eastern woman. If my husband wants to live in a tent, I will be happy being next to him in that tent. Now, okay, this may sound like an exaggeration, of course, but with this mindset, this woman would not be easily disappointed. And this friend of mine, by the way, is now a millionaire with 5 children, and they do live in a very nice home. In any case, without love, you cannot build a marriage. And that's why here in the betrothal service, the name of love is being confirmed before God and a number of witnesses. We mentioned that these words are not to be used loosely. Do not let these words come out of your mouth very easily. Don't be quick to say, I love you, to the other person. You must. You just met a few days ago. In the book of the Desert Fathers, we read about a young novice who went to the abbot and said, Yeranda, elder, I love you very much. The elder shook his head and said, I don't believe that you love me. But why, Yeranda? Why are you saying this? My son, to this day, I have yet to find a man who truly loves his neighbor. It is a great matter to tell another person that you love them. I love you means that I am ready to die for you. Not I want you to want to die for me, not to make you kill over from use and abuse. No, I'm ready to die for you regardless. Today, the opposite is usually the case. I don't care how you're feeling. I don't care if you're ready to drop. It doesn't matter. You must come through for me one way or the other. You must do whatever it takes to make me happy. And some poor young women come and confess, Father, I want to do everything to make him happy. Well, okay, that's commendable. But love is something very serious, and we must be very sincere And in order to keep sustaining love, we will need the help and support of God and a prayer life. Love is for life, not for just a few months. The words, "I love you," will be tested and tried time after time again. These words are tested and shaken whenever we face a crisis or a difficulty in marriage. Is the love you are talking about strong enough? Is it forever, as some young people like to write all over bridges? It is tragic to see people lose it after the first and second tremor, the first shakeup. "Oh, I made a mistake. I never really loved him." You never loved him? "Yes, now I see this, that I never loved him." Well, what happened to all those honeys and sweeties, all that initial syrup? Now, after 10, 15 years, you suddenly discover that you never loved him? Of course, many innocent souls pay very dearly for such irresponsibility and foolishness. You also need to know that the good captain proves himself in the middle of the storm. If you love your wife, I want to see what you're made of when she tells you, "I don't love you anymore," or when she does something that betrays your love. How will you react? "Oh, you're unfaithful, get out of my home. I don't want you anymore." This is not the love of an Orthodox Christian or a follower of Christ. What was the sign of Christ's love? He died for us while we were still sinners. The essence, the magnificence of God's love is this very point. He did not only love those who loved him, who were totally devoted to him, but he died for us who were inimical and hateful towards him. We did not desire him, we didn't choose him, and yet while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. It is not hard to die for someone who loves you, but it is very difficult to die for someone who hates you. It is very difficult to die for your enemy. But this is exactly what the God of love did. This is exactly what Christ did for us. He died for us by letting us crucify him. If you truly love your spouse, I want to see how you behave when you are deceived, denied, or betrayed by your better half. This is the most crucial time to show your love and to prove if the words you uttered during the honeymoon state are truly sustainable. "I love you" means forever, regardless of what happens. There's a joke about a man who went to work one day, and his co-workers noticed that he was wearing his wedding band on the index finger. One asked, why are you all of a sudden wearing your ring on the wrong finger?" "Well, because I just finally discovered that I married the wrong woman." Well, this is not so funny for a great number of people who wake up one day and always by the help of the demons begin to question themselves. "How do I really know if I married the right person?" Well, how do you know? Do you ever know? Not really. If you based your marriage on the chaff of romantic novels, magic wonderlands, and there are smoke screens about living happily ever after. The fact is that God and His church blessed your marriage and gave you all the gifts to make your initial romantic passive love into the love that never fails, lasting unconditional love. Every relationship faces the same dynamics, a certain cycle. In the beginning, you were attracted to your spouse. When they smiled, you felt the sun was smiling. You were infatuated. You couldn't wait for the phone to ring or to see them and be with that person, the person you fell in love with. We hear these stories all the time. "He swept me off my feet," or "I just fell in love." This just happened. You met or you were introduced, and after a few conversations, you began to feel emotionally connected. There was no doubt in your mind that this man or woman made you happy, complete, fulfilled. You were at a state of euphoria. You had endless conversations. You stayed up talking on the phone all night long. Falling in love was a spontaneous experience. you didn't have to do anything. Well, you did. Subconsciously, you put your best foot forward. You were trying to impress and to win the favor of the other person. And this is all good and quite natural in this fallen world. And if you think about it, this was not so difficult. All you had to do was to look your best, to find the best outfit, the best antiperspirant, a very pleasant aftershave or cologne, go to the most quaint coffee shops, parks, and so on. And after a month or two, you convinced yourself that life was not worth living without this beautiful person next to you. You even made statements that I don't want to live one day without you, and I'd rather die first because I can't stand the thought of living even one day without you. But after a few years of marriage, the euphoria of this kind of love fades. For most people, it lasts a year or two, if that. Slowly but surely, you now discover that your beloved spouse has $100,000 in student loans, a medical condition, a very difficult mother, and now some of the once cute idiosyncrasies of your spouse have become unbearable to you, not to mention the bills, the car payments, the mortgage, and the added pressure of having to wake up in the middle of the night to comfort a sick child or two. And now the evil one will come and fill your mind with all kinds of thoughts if you're not grounded in your faith. He will whisper to you, why did you need all this? You could have done so much better. You had other choices. You still have other choices. So in the absence of a seasoned spiritual father and a serious prayer life, the evil one will fill your imagination and continue to bring on the forefront every single negative trait of your spouse, every unpleasant memory, while erasing from your mind every happy moment. People can be married for 10 years, and in front of the marriage counselor, they will admit, I don't remember anything good about my marriage. It's been nothing but misery. This tragedy is experienced by 50-60% of today's couples who never understood what it means to love someone and who never laid the proper foundation. You heard the expression, a labor of love. This expression is very accurate when it comes to sustaining love. In common terms, if you don't keep supplying the fireplace with fresh wood, the fire will go out. There's no such thing as spontaneous combustion, at least not in this life. Only God creates out of zero. The initial euphoria of love and the optimism that comes along with it made you overlook the other person's faults and weaknesses, especially since love is blind, romantic love, that is. And just like there are specific things you must do to abide in God's love and sustaining grace, there are specific things you can do and must do to succeed and keep your marriage afloat. The young woman will usually begin to complain to her spiritually immature mother. Mom, I'm just not happy. Well, honey, if you're not happy, you know, we have options. And the options are quite obvious. But happiness and a blissful living do not describe the purpose of marriage. The primary purpose of marriage is man's salvation, to prepare him to unite with Christ, the eternal bridegroom. The goal is to transcend the sensual, the ephemeral, and to acquire an eternal relationship with God. When this is the goal and the hope, then and the long-term target, then you do not become despondent if your once Prince Charming does not live up to all your expectations. You never question if you married the right person or not, but you use these marital difficulties as a spiritual stepping stone, as a boot camp to transcend your egotism and exercise patience, perseverance, and forbearance. Because when you fell in love with this person, you prayed about it, You've received the blessing of the church and of your spiritual father. And since none of the above happened in the absence of God, then we must trust that any difficulties that come along will be for the benefit of our soul. Life is not a perpetual love affair and a perpetual honeymoon, as deceptively presented by the sirens of Hollywood. We don't develop spiritually in a state of euphoria. Deep humility and meekness are acquired by trials and difficulties. Without deep humility and meekness, we will never love God or our neighbor. So after a few months or years, our initial romantic, spontaneous, and free love will be tested. And now love becomes laborious, full of challenges, and in the absence of self-denial and self-transcendence, without that mantle of the romantic love, now we become critical, judgmental, and angered by our spouse's idiosyncrasies, stupidities, or as we like to now call them. And yet this is the best tool to work out our salvation, because marriage is pretty much like those two stones, and you may have heard this example before, those two rough stones that start off on the top of the mountain. They fall into a small creek, and they begin to roll downstream, and as they begin to hit each other, then their rough and asymmetrical edges break off, and slowly they develop and they become very well-rounded, beautiful river rock. Something similar happens in the spiritual life. We need to be very well of this, especially for people who had some kind of a conversion or a spiritual experience later in life. This also happens to many monks and many people in general. I remember a certain monk who visited Elder Paisios and said to him, "Elder, when I decided to become a monk, I was full of desire for God. I loved all night vigils. I loved the Bible. I loved the church. I was basking in grace. I had the gifts of tears. I was in love with the whole world. Everything was so blissful. Now that I became a monk, a few short years later, I feel dry. That initial love affair is gone. Nothing is easy. Everything is a struggle. And on top of that, I now have to struggle with all my previous passions, which resurfaced and attack my soul daily. My soul feels numb and even dead. Perhaps I made a mistake." The elder chuckled and explained to him, "My son, there's nothing wrong with what you're going through. God acts like a smart pastry maker who wants to entice people to enter and taste his goods. A smart shop owner will place a table on the sidewalk of his shop, and he will give free samples of cheesecake, pies, tiramisu, baklava, donuts. He will do this for a month or two until these customers fall in love with his sweets, and then they will enter his shop all by themselves to pay his expected price for each item. So God sweetens man and showers him with free grace. Man tastes and experiences the presence of God. He feels his grace, becomes full of zeal, loves everything about the church. He reads the scriptures, he devours book after book, he prays for hours. His life is smooth, temptations are put on hold, life becomes a dream. For those of us who experience this, we call this the honeymoon state. After a few years, God begins to slowly hide or pull his grace, not to punish us and to make us suffer, but to help us exit our spiritual infancy. Because almost without fail, during this time of free grace, man is also full of pride. He's usually very judgmental of others, critical. He wants to teach, preach, and change the world without having struggled to purify himself from these passions, which were put on hold for a while, free of charge. But after a few years, and with much experience of the grace of God, now man must exercise his free will if he wishes to sustain this grace. The first presupposition for God's grace to abide in our heart is a contrite spirit. The humble mindset, humility, does not come by reading books or by attending retreats or by simply thinking that I'm a sinner, a fallen man, I'm arrogant and disobedient. All these things humble our mind for a while, but the depth of our heart is not humbled by humble and holy thoughts. The depth of our heart is humbled and beautified by spiritual warfare, by temptations, trials, abandonment, and afflictions. These are the tools that build and develop our soul with a foundation of humility. Humility is the belief or the knowledge that God is in control of everything, and we surrender our life voluntarily. We have free will. We surrender our life to the will of God, and we follow His guidance. We provide our desire to follow Him, and we constantly ask for His will to be done in our lives. And now we'll complete the last couple lines of this prayer, of this section of the prayer. For you, O Lord, from the beginning have created male and female, and by you is a woman joined to man for assistance and for the continuation of the human race. And here we need to say a few things about Christian anthropology, or the creation of men, the creation of gender specifically. All the fathers of the church agree and teach that the presence of gender and sexual reproduction was not the pre-eternal or primary will of God. God, in His foreknowledge of the fall, made the male and female and blessed marriage as a way to help humankind to re-enter paradise by each other's assistance. This may surprise some of you, but proof for this is presented by Christ Himself, who is the only man who lived the katevdokian, or perfect will of God, 100% of the time. If marriage was in fact the pre-eternal and perfect will of God, then Christ would have to assume that form on His nature, or He would be lacking something. The fact that marriage and the marital union took place after the fall, the fact that Christ, the Virgin Mary, St. John the Baptist, lived in virginity, and the fact that there will be no marriage in the kingdom of God clearly shows that marriage is simply a form of this age and not the primary will of God. Furthermore, Christ, the perfect man, was not conceived by sexual reproduction, which is consequential of the fall, but He was conceived as sporos, without seed, by the Holy Spirit and the ever-Virgin Mary. This does not mean that we are downgrading the importance of marriage. God in His wisdom blessed this form and included it in the plan of man's salvation. Marriage is consequential of the fall, and we will continue to repeat at every one of these sessions that the primary purpose of marriage is the healing of the fallen nature, the healing of the carnal desires, the transcendence of marriage, and the marriage of men with the bridegroom Christ. The purpose is not to stay attached to the marital pleasures by using all kinds of lust potions and demonic chemicals, but we slowly need to transcend all these niceties of the world. We consider them skivala, according to St. Paul. Rubbish, as St. Paul says. So we can have an eternal relationship with God. So God made the male and female. A woman is joined to a man. And here is, in this part of the prayer, one can see the three purposes of marriage. If you notice here, childbearing, the procreation, is placed after the other two purposes. And the absence of children does not nullify the main purpose of marriage. The primary purpose of marriage is to transcend our fallen nature. The secondary purpose is the avoidance of carnal sin or fornication, as St. Paul explains to the Corinthians. He suggests to them that due to your inability to have self-control, to remain celibate, choose a wife so you can help each other in the transcendence of these desires. And number three, the tertiary purpose of marriage is procreation and the continuation of the human race according to this prayer.